All right. Well, welcome, ladies and gentlemen. Let's review for a couple moments so where we've been so far in our journey here. We're at week 6 of our Doctrine of Christ class. And now we've, over the last few weeks, we've studied the meaning of the word incarnation. We learned that it means God taking on human flesh. We studied the pre-incarnate Christ, meaning we asked and answered the question, so who was Christ prior coming to earth? Where can he be found in the Old Testament? We studied the experience of the incarnation, meaning attempts to explain how it could have worked out in the life of Jesus of Nazareth. We studied the virgin birth. We studied the life and the ministry of Jesus. We've studied the death of Christ and did our best to ask and answer the question, why was it necessary, his death, and what did it accomplish? And now today we're looking at the resurrection of Jesus Christ. Now, what does that word mean? What does it mean, the resurrection? Resurrection is Jesus coming back to life after dying, but coming back to life in a body that is a hybrid, natural and supernatural. Meaning, Lazarus was not resurrected. Lazarus was resuscitated, but Lazarus died again. Lazarus didn't have a resurrected body. Jesus was resurrected from the dead. So he had a body and still has access to a body that is a glorified body. It's the body the Apostle Paul talks about in 1 Corinthians. It's a supernatural body. This mortal will put on immortality. This corruptible will put on incorruption. That's the resurrection body that every follower of Jesus someday will receive in the end times as well. That's what a resurrection is. You die and you come back to life, but not just in a normal body, but in a physical body that is also a glorified supernatural body, a hybrid, if you will. And why was the resurrection necessary? Why did this have to happen? Well, the event of the resurrection validated Jesus' claims. So anybody can make claims about himself, about his interaction with God, claims about his authority. His resurrection validated that what he was saying his whole life was actually true. He was raised from the dead. He rose from the dead. And so his resurrection clearly displayed and sealed his victory for everyone to see. Now let's read essentially the foundation of the resurrection just from one of the Gospels. I'll be reading from John chapter 20, starting at verse 1. If you have your Bible, why not read along with me? John chapter 20, verse 1 to 18. Says, early on the first day of the week, while it was still dark, Mary Magdalene went to the tomb and saw that the stone had been removed from the entrance. So she came running to Simon Peter and the other disciple, the one Jesus loved, which would be John, apparently, who's writing this, and said, they have taken the Lord out of the tomb and we don't know where they have put him. So Peter and the other disciple started for the tomb. It was a race. Both were running, but the other disciple outran Peter. John says, if I don't say so myself, I beat him there. And reached the tomb first. He bent over and looked in at the strips of linen lying there, but did not go in. Then Simon Peter came along behind him and went straight into the tomb. He saw the strips of linen lying there, as well as the cloth that had been wrapped around Jesus' head. The cloth was still lying in its place, separate from the linen. Finally, the other disciple who had reached the tomb first, he wanted to remind us of that, also went inside. He saw and believed. They still did not understand from scriptures that Jesus had to rise from the dead. Remember that. This is an unexpected event. Then the disciples went back to where they were staying. Now Mary stood outside the tomb crying. As she wept, she bent over to look into the tomb and saw two angels in white seated where Jesus' body had been, one at the head and the other at the foot. They asked her, woman, why are you crying? They've taken my Lord away, she said, and I don't know where they put him. At this, she turned around and saw Jesus standing there, and but she didn't realize that it was Jesus. He asked her, woman, why are you crying? Who is it you're looking for? Thinking he was the gardener, she said, sir, if you have carried him away, tell me where you have put him, and I will get him. Jesus said to her, Mary. She turned toward him and cried out in Aramaic, Rabboni, which means teacher. Jesus said, don't hold on to me, for I have not yet ascended to the Father. Go instead to my brothers and tell them, I am ascending to my Father and your Father, to my God and your God. Mary Magdalene went to the disciples with the news, I have seen the Lord, and she told them that he said these things to her. So, here's the thing. There's an important distinction between knowing and showing. I'm going to say that again. There's an important distinction between knowing something and showing something. Our faith in Jesus Christ is rooted in a personal experience with the indwelling Spirit of God. Our faith is not ultimately rooted in arguments or historical evidences. An illiterate and uneducated person living in a hut in northern Siberia can know that Jesus Christ is alive based entirely upon their personal experience of and relationship with the Spirit of God. In fact, as I say that, I have been in a hut in northern Siberia with followers of Jesus. I think of this right now. I was invited there years ago. My daughter Katie went with me, and we spent a couple of weeks in Siberia teaching and preaching in a church there and teaching on the evidences for Christianity. And it just occurs to me as I'm standing here, that these people were already followers of Jesus. They had no concept of apologetics or anything. They had not been taught any of this, yet they had an experience with the indwelling Christ. They already knew what I was showing them. So there's showing and there's knowing. And we know based entirely on our personal experience of and relationship with the Spirit of God. In other words, you're justified to believe that your experiences of life are true, unless you've been confronted with a defeater of your experiences. Unless and until some irrefutable fact exposes your beliefs and experiences as false, you're completely legitimate to believe your experiences are true. I have had an experience with God. And until I have a defeater of my experiences, something that shows and proves that my experience was false, I am justified to believe that what I experienced is true. Okay? Well, you say, well, what about a Mormon who has the burning in the bosom, or a Hindu who has had some supernatural experiences? They are justified in believing their experiences are true until a defeater can be brought to them. And I could have a defeater with a Mormon, showing that the foundation of their beliefs are actually unhistorical and not true. I could challenge a Hindu with their understanding of the universe and how it doesn't actually fit with reality. So we could bring a defeater to those experiences. Having said that, when you are able to provide facts and evidences in support of what you've experienced, showing what you've experienced to be true, it makes your experience all that much more powerful and certain. So that's what we're going to do for the next few moments. Today, we're not discussing the foundation of the source of our faith. That foundation, that source, is the witness of the indwelling Spirit with our spirit. What we're discussing today is some evidence that supports and affirms and validates the foundation and source of our faith. What we're discussing today is a way to show with our minds what we know in our hearts when it comes to the resurrection of Jesus. So, what we're about to look at are four historical facts surrounding the resurrection of Christ. Four historical facts that, for all intents and purposes, aren't really in dispute, meaning atheist, agnostic, theistic, Christian, non-Christian, scholars, historians, essentially, there are outliers, but essentially they agree on these four historical facts. The four facts we're going to quickly look at are really not in dispute, okay? Historical fact number one on your outline. After his crucifixion, Jesus was buried in the tomb of Joseph of Arimathea. Historical fact, not disputed. Joseph of Arimathea, think about this. We know the name of the guy who owned the tomb. Joseph of Arimathea was a member of the Jewish Sanhedrin, an ancient Jewish law court. It was the court that sentenced Jesus to death and then convinced the Romans to have Christ crucified. The ancient documents declare that after Jesus died, his body was wrapped, then buried in the tomb that was donated by this member of the Sanhedrin, Joseph of Arimathea. Now, historians find this fact to be a highly credible, believable, due to what they refer to as the embarrassment factor. There are different factors historians look to find out whether something's true or not. Dissimilarity, meaning if it's uniquely different from anything in Judaism before or Christianity afterwards, if it's really unique, that tends to be probably likely true. It stands out. Or if it has contextually credible, meaning it agrees with what we already know about Jesus, chances are that's true. One of the factors that they look for, whether something's historically reliable in Scripture, is embarrassment. What does that mean? Meaning that if something is embarrassing to the church or embarrassing to Christ, then chances are it wasn't added on later as something false. You wouldn't make up something stupid about yourself in your biography You try to make yourself look stronger. Or your hero, you wouldn't make up something silly or embarrassing. So if there's something, an embarrassing fact, chances are it's likely true. Okay, it's called the embarrassment factor. Now, how is this, Jesus being put in Joseph of Arimathea's tomb, an embarrassing thing? Well, it's highly unlikely that this is a later legendary embellishment, since you have one of the enemies of the early church, a member of the judicial body that had Jesus killed, you have one of these members acting in a heroic manner. Early Christians inventing the story that Joseph of Arimathea buried Jesus would be like modern Israel inventing a story that Hitler secretly rescued Jewish children from concentration camps. It wouldn't happen. You wouldn't make that up. For this, among other reasons, historians agree, after his crucifixion, Jesus was buried in the tomb of Joseph of Arimathea. Historical fact number two. On the Sunday following his death, the tomb of Jesus Christ was found to be empty by his women followers. The tomb was found to be empty by his women followers. Now get this, folks, this is crucial. The empty tomb is a fact of history. Realize this. This is not disputed. This is the fact of history. Historians will debate how the tomb became empty, but they don't debate if the tomb was empty. They agreed the tomb was empty. The fact that the tomb was found empty by a group of women followers serves as another powerful sign of authenticity to ancient historians, again, due to the embarrassment factor. Now, why was this factor embarrassing? Now, don't shoot the messenger here. I'm just telling you this, okay? As distasteful as it is to our modern sensibilities, the testimony of women was not acceptable in ancient Jewish courts. Women were simply not trusted as reliable witnesses. So an invented account of the circumstances surrounding the empty tomb would certainly not have the first witnesses be women. An invented account would have Peter or John or some other group of incredibly influential, important men. They would be the first witnesses. But the fact that the manuscripts record that it was women who couldn't testify in court who first witnessed the empty tomb, that is a strong sign of unvarnished, honest testimony. Historical fact number three. On separate, multiple occasions, different individuals and groups of individuals, including 500 at one time, saw what they claimed to be appearances of Jesus alive after his death. Individuals, groups, including 500 at one time, saw what they claimed to be appearances of Jesus alive after his death. This is not disputed. Think about this. These appearances were witnessed not just by believers, but by unbelievers, by skeptics, and even enemies of Christ. Now, this is an important fact because any appeal to hallucinations, which we'll touch on in a bit, or wish fulfillment simply doesn't fit the historical facts. As one example, the undeniable facts behind the story of the man known as Saul of Tarsus, that we know as the Apostle Paul, is a crucial piece of history that has to be addressed by people who deny the resurrection. Saul was a Jewish religious scholar, and by his own account, a zealot, who was an enemy of Christ or the early Christ followers. There's no history that he ever interacted with Christ prior. Saul terrorized the early church. He hunted down and he killed the first Christians. While on one of his seek and destroy missions, Saul claimed to have had an encounter with the resurrected Christ. This encounter instantly changed the direction of Saul's life. In literally an instant, Saul turned from being a killer of Christians to being a follower of Christ in an instant. That would be akin to Osama bin Laden being the leader of Al-Qaeda at 11 a.m. and being a member of President Bush's cabinet at 11:01 a.m. That would be akin to President Biden being the head of the Democrat Party at noon and being a MAGA Republican at 12:01. Actually, Joe might be able to pull that one off. But you know what I'm saying? It's just this radical, instant change. Historians marvel, what could cause such a powerful, radical, instant turnaround? Saul claimed that he met the resurrected Christ and he would later die because of that claim. Scholars are in agreement that the historical record reports multiple early independent eyewitnesses accounts. These multiple early independent testimonies, even eyewitness testimony from enemies and combatants, must be accounted for. Historical fact number four. The original disciples suddenly came to believe in the resurrection of Jesus. 1S, 2Rs. The resurrection of Jesus, despite having no expectation of it. Remember, we read that in John. They still, even at the empty tomb, they didn't put the pieces together yet. Why is this? As one scholar put it, you need a sufficient launching pad to explain the launch of the missile, the rocket called Christianity. And it can't be a gradual ramp of legend being built up over decades and generations. It was an instant liftoff. Men and women who were one day hiding and cowering and denying that they even knew Christ were the next day willing to die for the claim that he had risen from the dead. Something happened, literally in an instant, that has to be explained. Now, it's important to understand that the original disciples had absolutely no expectation of a dying and rising Messiah. When we think Messiah, we think, oh yeah, the Messiah who comes and he dies and he rises from the dead. Yeah, that's 2,000 years later. The Messiah dying was like Superman dying to a Jewish mind. It was unthinkable. A dying Messiah is an oxymoron. It's two opposite things put together. Add to that the fact that according to Jewish law, Jesus' method of death was considered evidence that he was under God's curse, not the Messiah. Plus, add to that the fact that Jewish beliefs in the afterlife did not anticipate anyone being resurrected until the very end of the world, and you come to the realization that the resurrection of Jesus was a completely unanticipated event. A scholar, Dr. N.T. Wright, put it, and I quote him, "In the first century, when your Messiah died, you either went home or you got yourself a new Messiah." Now, if we want to be rational, we need to deal with the facts, because when you're rational, facts are your friends, right? So what are the facts of this case? Well, here's what we know. Here's what's not disputed. After his crucifixion, Jesus was buried in the tomb of Joseph of Arimathea. On the Sunday following his death, the tomb of Jesus was found to be empty by his women followers. On separate, multiple occasions, different individuals and groups of individuals, including 500 at one time, saw what they claimed to be appearances of Jesus alive after his death. And the original disciples suddenly came to believe in the resurrection of Jesus, despite having no expectation of it. Now, as honest detectives, as men and women who are willing to follow wherever the evidence leads, our explanation needs to account for all four of those facts. And here's the thing. Every naturalistic, meaning non-supernatural explanation of the resurrection event for the last 2,000 years has been universally rejected by contemporary scholarship, meaning there's not any one of them that everyone gathers around and says, yeah, that's the answer. Understand this, and this is an area I've spent literally 40 years of my life investigating. There is not one single naturalistic theory that is able to explain all the known historical facts of the case. Not one. Now, don't take my word for it. Let me show you. So what are the competing theories to the eyewitness claims of Jesus' first followers? What rational alternatives does 2,000 years worth of skepticism offer us? Here we go. The first one on your outline, the theft theory. The theft theory. Theft. Okay? The disciples came and stole the body. The disciples came and stole the body. That was the first naturalistic explanation, wasn't it? That's the one you see in Scripture. Remember, the argument was, the guard said, while we were sleeping, the disciples came and stole the body. Now, what are the problems with this theory? Okay, the disciples came and stole the body. You mean the same guys who hid when Jesus was arrested, shrank from a woman's accusation around a campfire, and then were too afraid to even claim his body? Those same disciples went and stole the body then? These guys suddenly conspired together to steal the body, potentially confront the guards. They didn't know the guards would be sleeping. And steal this body, and then make up a resurrection story, hide the body forever, and then go around saying Jesus rose from the dead? couple problems with that there. Number one, how can sleeping guards identify people? Most people sleep with their eyes closed. When you're asleep, how can you identify something? And what about the resurrection appearances, including to the enemies of Jesus? This doesn't make sense. And does an outright lie explain the disciples' lives from that day forward? Nobody who reads, and I'm talking agnostic, anti-Christian, atheist, Christian scholars, no historians looking at the New Testament Gospels, the disciples in the Gospels, claim that these people were liars. That theory isn't put forward. These are not liars. An outright lie doesn't explain their lives from that day forward. Some of them died for this, for their faith. And, you know, would a person die for a lie? Well, what do they gain? They didn't go on book tours. They didn't go on Oprah, you know. They didn't make a lot of money. Some of them lost their livelihoods, right? So what would be the gain? You say, well, Darren, other people die for their faith. What about Muslims who are willing to die for their faith? Mormons are willing to die for their faith. Dying for your faith doesn't prove that your faith is true. That is true, but there's a difference here. It's one thing to die for something you've been told that you later find out is a lie. So I was told something and I'm willing to die for that. That's different than I am the source of the lie and I'm willing to die for something I know is a lie. And I'm willing to watch my family die for something that I know is a lie. That's the difference. The theft theory has not been proposed as a viable alternative for nearly 2,000 years. Number two, the no burial theory. The no burial theory. This is that the body was thrown into a pit, not the tomb. The body was thrown into a pit, not the tomb. So this theory goes like this. You know, the Romans crucified thousands of people. And so on this day, Jesus' body was taken down from the cross, and he wasn't placed in a tomb. He was placed in a mass grave, a pit, where other crucified individuals were placed. It wasn't a dignified burial. This was a Jewish rebel, a thief. You know, he was cursed. He was rejected. So they threw his body into a pit, but the disciples thought he'd been placed in a tomb. So the women went to the tomb, saw it empty, and thought he'd been placed in there. Simple mistake. What's the problems with this theory? Why wouldn't the Jewish authorities and the Romans simply produce the real body? Oh, time out, gang. No. Jesus hasn't been raised from the dead. Oh, over there, you know, Antonius, show them where the body is. There he is. He's in a pit right there. Ah, okay. Shut down all this preaching and teaching. And what about the resurrection appearances? This doesn't explain all the appearances that Jesus made to people. This theory was never really a serious consideration, and as far as I know, has absolutely no modern-day support as a viable alternative. Number three, the wrong tomb theory. The wrong tomb theory. This is the theory that the women accidentally went to the wrong tomb on Easter morning. You know, women and directions. So this is a theory that, you know, the ladies, you know, they go into the cemetery, the place there where there's other tombs, and instead of turning left, they turned right, and they went to the wrong tomb. They saw it empty, and they thought Jesus was in that tomb when he was in the other one that was still sealed. What are the problems with this theory, other than it being just plain dumb? Well, why wouldn't the Jewish leaders and the Roman authorities kindly point them to the correct tomb? Antonius, pull the stone away. Look in there, say, oh, yeah, oof, yeah, he's in there. That's Jesus. I mean, it would have been a simple fix. And what about the resurrection appearances? This doesn't explain or account for the several resurrection appearances. This theory never got any traction, and as far as I know, has no modern-day support among scholars. Next, the hallucination theory. The hallucination theory. This is that the resurrection appearances were mere hallucinations. Okay? They were mere hallucinations. In other words, Jesus' followers so loved him, were so impacted by his life, that when he died, their minds just couldn't grasp what was going on. This just didn't make sense. And so they're so grief-stricken by it all. And there's wish fulfillment happening here. They so wish he was still alive that, you know, your mind does funny things. And they actually saw what they wished was true. And they hallucinated that they saw Jesus. Now, what are the problems with this theory? Why wouldn't the Jewish leaders and the Romans produce the body and end all the hallucinating? You think you saw him? No, there's his body. So in here now, you've got to start combining theories. Somehow the body being stolen and plus everybody hallucinating. But why would you be hallucinating if you know that you stole the body? You know he's not alive. So they're alive. They're fighting each other now, these theories. They're not working together. It's becoming more ad hoc and more contrived. Why wouldn't the Jewish and Romans just produce the real body and end all the hallucinating? Plus, this theory doesn't fit all the facts for Jesus' appearances to his disciples as a group. Remember, a crowd of 500 at one time, Corinthians says. I can have a hallucination, you can have a hallucination, but we can't network our hallucinations. Hallucinations are very personal things, okay? Plus, preconditioning is a major factor in hallucinations. This theory of hallucinations doesn't fit the facts regarding the state of mind of the disciples. For example, so they weren't expecting Jesus to rise from the dead. This wasn't a matter of wish fulfillment in that sense. Plus, James, Jesus' brother, who was not a follower of Jesus, who in fact called Jesus crazy until Jesus appeared to him after Jesus rose from the dead. So James didn't have a wish fulfillment. James, you know, it was like out of nowhere. He thought his brother was crazy. And then Jesus made a special appearance for him, Scripture says. Or it doesn't address the Apostle Paul or Saul. He hated Christians. He was hunting down and killing Christians. And he became a disciple, a follower of Jesus, based on a resurrection appearance. There's no wish fulfillment for Saul. It doesn't make sense. This was his worst nightmare at first. Plus, when one has a hallucination involving a deceased person, you don't take that hallucination as a sign the person's alive, but as a confirmation that they're dead. Again, this theory was proposed in the early 20th century, and although people will nibble at it and refer to it, no one will actually say, yes, that's the theory that I hold to. It has no scholarly support that I'm aware of today. Next is the swoon theory. The swoon theory. This is the theory that Jesus only fainted on the cross, and he resuscitated in the cool tomb. Resuscitated. Spelling there. Resuscitated. Oh, there should be an S. He resuscitated in the cool tomb and escaped. Now, this is a unique theory. So, Jesus is on the cross. He's hanging there. He slips into maybe a coma or something, and they think he's dead. And so they take him down from the tomb, from the cross. They wrap him up. They take him into his tomb. They put him in the tomb. In the tomb, the coolness of the tomb resuscitates him. He wakes up. And on his own, after being beaten and with a 39 lashes, stabbed in the side, piercing his pericardium and his aorta, the whipping, the beating, the carrying the cross, 6 hours on the cross, all that, he resuscitates in the cool tomb. Somehow, with his nail-pierced hands and feet, he unwraps himself, folds up the one blanket, and then from the inside the tomb, he, by himself, moves the stone from inside the tomb, without the guards seeing it apparently, sneaks away, appears to his followers in this emaciated, beaten, whipped body, and says, I've raised from the dead, and you too can have a body like this someday. And then he sneaks away, never to be seen again. That's the swoon theory. What's the problem with that? Well, there's lots of problems with it, just on its face. But Jesus was beaten, whipped 39 times, carried a wooden cross through the city, nailed, hung for 6 hours, stabbed in the side of the chest. Could a crucified man do that, unwrap himself, single-handedly move the stone from the inside, slip past the guards, walk through the streets several miles up to Galilee, inspire his disciples and hundreds of others by his appearance, and then disappear forever? I'm not aware of any contemporary historians or New Testament scholars who subscribe to this theory. Well, that there you have it. Now, what's the state of the art? The most recent one is the, here's the most recent one. It's not on your outline. This theory is this. Apparently, Jesus, at birth, had an identical twin brother. I'm not making this up. He had an identical twin brother, and they were separated at birth. And that identical twin just happened to wander into Jerusalem at this period. And people saw him and thought it was Jesus. And so he kind of pretended he was Jesus for a while. Why you would want to pretend you're someone the Romans had just crucified, I'm not sure. But he kind of fooled people for a while, made these appearances. That is the state of the art. The only explanation that factors in all of the known historical facts is the resurrection of Jesus. That's why the follower of Christ is experientially, historically, intellectually justified in both believing and declaring that Jesus rose from the dead, proving that he was who he claimed to be, God come to earth in the flesh. So we've got about 7 or 10 minutes or so for questions about what we've talked about today. Let's open it up for any questions about what we discussed today. Yes, sir. Yeah, great question. Why in some instances did the people not recognize him right away? And a couple times in the Gospels, it says they were kept from recognizing him. So particularly I can think on the road to Emmaus when Jesus is there and he's walking along with a couple disciples and he's asking them questions. What are you so sad about? And so on. And it wasn't until he broke the bread that he allowed them to recognize who he was. I think in those instances, clearly that there was a sort of an epistemic reason. There was a teaching reason. He was drawing truth out of them. He was getting them to think and to learn and to process the truth that he could then reveal to them. So it was a teaching method is what this was all about. Good question. Yes, at the very back. My personal opinion about the Shroud of Turin. By the way, Stephen Lamb, yeah, Dr. Lamb, you're here. You asked a couple of weeks ago if there was any DNA stuff with the shroud, and I looked into that. And there's all sorts of DNA all over it, but it's from people from all over the world. So it's literally been handled for centuries, and so people literally, they can tell where the people were from and so on, and even some plants and so on from the Middle East and so on, there's DNA on it, but there's no definitive DNA that they have found. So my opinion of it, I'm an agnostic when it comes to the shroud. I don't put a lot of weight on it, but people that I respect do put a lot of weight on it. So who knows? It's undergone all sorts of testing over the years. At first, they thought, no, it's proven that it was a much later thing. And then they came to realize, oh, no, actually, that testing wasn't true. So the jury is still out, literally, on that. Any other questions about what we learned today? Yes, Bob. That's a great question. With all this compelling evidence, why would a logically thinking individual not do this? I think, well, some people reject this evidence, not based on the historicity of it, but an a priori rejection, meaning beforehand, they just reject any concept of miracles, they reject any belief in the supernatural or God. So they would say that even the most far-fetched explanation is better than a supernatural explanation. Even the most convoluted naturalistic one in their minds, because of their a priori assumptions ahead of time, the rejection from the jump that there is no God and there are no miracles, then even the most bizarre naturalist one is better than what seems to be an obvious supernatural one. So there's that. Also, I think to a great degree that there's a heart issue here. There's a pride issue. It's the state of the human heart. Sometimes people ask, why wouldn't Jesus appear to the high priest? Now, who knows? Maybe he did, and it's not recorded. We don't know, and the high priest never told anyone. The Bible does say that many priests believed afterwards. But think of the human heart of the priests and the Sanhedrin, the priests, when it was reported to them that from the guards that Jesus had risen from the dead. What did they say? Here's what I want you to tell people. Tell people while you were sleeping, the disciples came and stole the body. We'll take care of, normally sleeping guards get killed. We'll take care of it. Don't worry. We'll take care of that for you. But here's what we want you to tell them, people, and we'll pay you money to say that. What kind of heart, what kind of stubbornness, what kind of arrogance would it take to say, okay, man, well, we just have to deny this somehow. We've got to cover it up. We can't have Jesus rising from the dead, so we got to make up a story. The depth of sin in the human heart is astounding. Yeah, such a strong belief in a lie, you refuse to accept the truth. I mean, Paul talks about that in Romans. Yeah. Yes, sir. That's a very good point, is that the fact that none of the disciples denied the resurrection, what they saw and experienced, and some of them died. I don't know that historically we could say all of them died for their faith, but certainly some of them did historically. But all of them at least died as followers of Jesus, and many others did as well. But particularly the disciples to whom Jesus made these resurrection appearances, you think over the years, like if you learned anything from Watergate scandal, the lie is going to come out. When there's a scandal, somebody's going to give somewhere. The truth is going to come out. None of that ever happened. They saw this. They were tortured, persecuted, some martyred for this. And all of them to their graves said, I saw what I saw. Yeah. Yes. Okay, great question. So, and that's very intuitive. You know why I didn't include it here. She's pointing out that many Muslims believe, like the Quran says, Jesus did not die, nor was he crucified. And so some Muslims believe in the swoon theory. Others believe in the Jesus replacement theory, that Allah put a Jesus lookalike on the cross. The real Jesus was taken up into heaven, did not die. So I think about this. As a Muslim, you believe that Muhammad's dead, but Jesus is alive. It's awkward. But they believe Jesus was taken up into heaven. There's a Jesus lookalike on the cross who he was killed then. And why I don't include that here, because these are naturalistic theories, and that's a supernatural theory. That's not a naturalistic theory. That's why I didn't include it. And on the face of it, it's just, it makes Allah the source of the greatest lie in human history. Because a Muslim would say Jesus was not raised from the dead. But if that's true, then Allah, and I say Allah and not God because I do not equate the two. So Allah, he created the conditions for Christianity. He set up all the circumstances that made it look like Jesus rose from the dead. So what kind of an intelligent God would do this. Let me set it up so it looks like Jesus rose from the dead, and then I will have Muhammad and his followers for 1,500 years deny that Jesus rose from the dead, but then they'll have to fight what I did. It just doesn't make sense. It's very convoluted and doesn't fit the facts of history. Any other questions? Oh, yes, sorry. Yes. Yes. Great question. And it's a distinction that has a difference. So we tend to use the same verb sometimes, but in different meanings. So we say Lazarus was raised from the dead, and Jesus was raised from the dead. And that is true. But they are raised from the dead in different ways. Lazarus was resuscitated, meaning his natural body came back to life. Jesus was resurrected, not resuscitated. Jesus' supernatural, glorified, eternal body came out of the grave. With Lazarus, his natural body came out of the grave. Jesus, his supernatural body came out of the grave. Lazarus died again. Jesus has a body that's immortal, that you will have and I will have as followers of Jesus someday. So the quality of the body is the distinction between a resuscitation and a resurrection. Raising from someone from the dead, yeah. Be a resuscitation, yeah. Not a resurrection. So Jesus, the Bible says, is the first fruits of the resurrection. He's the first one to be resurrected. And then everyone will come after him. He's the firstborn over all creation. He's the first fruits of the grave and so on. So if Lazarus had been resurrected, then Jesus wouldn't have been the first one resurrected. So there's a difference between a resuscitation and a resurrection. We call both the vernacular, they're both raised from the dead, but in different ways. One to die again, the other to never die. All right, last one, question back. Oh, and then one over here. Pardon me, sir? Some people believe he didn't die 2,000 years ago. If I understand your question correctly, there's historically, there is no doubt. The one thing that everybody agrees on, atheist, deeply conservative, theist, Christian, the one thing everyone agrees on is Jesus died. And he died the year, we're not quite sure because we're not sure when the calendar started, 30 to 35, somewhere in there, AD, that he certainly died under Pontius Pilate. Historically, we know that happened, and we know when it happened. There's no doubt about that historically. Some people, they believe those events happened recently. More recent than, yeah. Yeah, they don't have any history to base that on. That's right. Raised. Yeah, Nain. 3 days, I think. A couple days, yeah. Well, yeah, so where was Lazarus' soul at that point? Probably in paradise, or not in paradise, and what we know, now you've gotten into a whole bunny trail. But what we know is hell, but Abraham's bosom, put it that way. And then it would have been called out of there, I can assume. I'm sure Lazarus was a fascinating dinner guest. Let me put it that way. Next week, we're concluding our Christology course, and we're going to talk about the ascension of Jesus and the return of Jesus. We're going to talk about that next week. God bless you. Thank you for being here today.